From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump visited Florida today to see people affected by Hurricane Irma. Here he is speaking with Vice President Mike Pence and Florida Governor Rick Scott at the airport in Fort Myers.
This has been a difficult situation. As Rick knows, almost all of the roads are now open, and the ports are just about open. What we had to do to get some of those ports open, people wouldn't even believe that we did it so quickly. So we're very proud of the job that everybody around has done. Thank you all. Thank you very much. We'll see you later.
Meanwhile, back in Washington, conservative lawmakers are furious over a late-night deal leading Democrats say they struck with President Trump to save the immigration program known as DACA. For more, we're joined by NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, hi.
Hey, Jeremy.
So let's start with the federal response to Hurricane Irma and Harvey. Trump has been in Florida today where millions are still without power, but has he announced any new aid or assistance for those affected?
No, he hasn't been expected to. There was nothing on that going in. You know, it's a little bit like the first trip after Harvey to assess the area, see what things are like, really kind of connect with the people there. You know, when I talked to Republican aides before his Harvey trip, they said that it's really important to see what is going on the ground and actually be there in person to really to be able to understand the magnitude of it.
And he was criticized during that first trip to Texas because he didn't meet with any victims when he went down there.
Yeah, and then he did later when he went the following Saturday. He didn't meet with victims there, but you know, it's a difficult situation for a president because they have to figure out where they interfere because they run with such a big entourage versus where they can be helpful.
Okay, let's talk about DACA because it's very confusing what we've seen over the last day or so. There was a statement last night from House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi and the Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer. They said they had agreed that the president would support enshrining DACA protections into law and wouldn't demand the border wall in exchange. Trump is now denying that they struck any such deal last night after conservative backlash. Today, Paul Ryan played down the Democrats' statement. Let's listen.
There is no agreement. The president and the chief of staff called me from Air Force One today to discuss what was discussed. And it was a discussion, not an agreement or a negotiation.
So, Domenico, deal, no deal? What's going on here?
Well, and you saw the president push back a little bit against Chuck and Nancy, or Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, who he likes to refer to as Chuck and Nancy, saying that that there was no deal. But he did note that there was an agreement and that they got fairly close to a deal with some broad outlines, including border security. This is really the president watching his right flank. Immigration has been the animating issue more so than almost anything over the past decade. You know, even Obamacare or healthcare really weren't the sort of initiating conservative galvanizing force that immigration was. And immigration has always been very difficult. It's something that Trump is trying to figure out the politics of because he may very well be in favor of giving Dreamers the ability to stay in the country like he tried to make the argument for. But it's going to test his conservative base and it's going to be a little bit of a jungle to sort of wade through politically. On the other side of this, you've got political leaders, Republican leaders, who are kind of out of the loop on some of this. You didn't see Republicans in that meeting with President Trump and Pelosi and Schumer. And what you've got here is Paul Ryan reminding the White House that he controls the House agenda and he needs to get a majority of the majority in order to proceed.
But there's also a very clear and big change in the president's thinking on this issue. He tweeted today, does anybody really want to throw out good, educated, and accomplished young people who have jobs, some serving in the military? Really? And then here is the president speaking with Chuck Todd on NBC in 2015.
You'll rescind that one, too?
One good thing
you'll rescind the Dream Act executive order,
have to,
the DACA.
We have to make a whole new set of standards. And when people come in, they have
so
to come
gonna
in.
You're going to split up families.
Chuck,
you're going to deport children.
Chuck, no, no. We're going to keep the families together. We have to keep the families together.
But you're going to keep them together
out? But they have to go.
What if they have no place to go?
We will work with them. They have to go.
They have to go. Sounds very different than what he's saying today.
Yeah, and that is definitely obviously a big reversal from the campaign. But even during the campaign, there was some question to Trump's real thinking on this, because there was a report out during the campaign that that Trump at one point met with some Dreamers before the campaign, and in wanting to impress them, wanting to win them over, he talked to them at first, kind of grilled them a little bit and said, you know, why is your case more important than someone else's? And then by the end, they all took photos together and said, you've won me over. So when people heard him during the campaign, they wondered, is this the real Trump or not?
All right. Let me ask you about something else that's going on in Washington, which is that Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders yesterday proposed his Medicare for All bill. Let's listen to the senator.
Today, we begin the long and difficult struggle to end the international disgrace of the United States, our great nation, being the only major country on earth not to guarantee health care to all of our people.
Sanders speaking there yesterday with nearly a third of the Senate Democratic caucus behind him. How is this being received in Washington?
Well, politically, look, first of all, I see this as the inception of the hashtag Bernie primary. You know, I'm trying to get that thing started, so go ahead and tweet that out. You know, you saw Bernie, it was this odd event where he had all of these Democrats who potentially could run for president at some point who were taking turns at the microphone trying to appear to be the person who's the real inheritor of the Sanders crown when it comes to progressivism. Look, there's no chance that this legislation is going to pass today, and there are several avenues for Democrats to try to think about moving in that direction. But you're seeing this movement within the party anyway to get more to the point of believing in single payer.
It does seem like there are people you wouldn't expect to be on board with at least the idea of talking about this, like Senator Joe Manchin, who's one of the most conservative Democrats.
Yeah, but that's true. But, you know, Medicare is also very popular in Virginia. And if he feels like he can make the case to people that this would be similar to Medicare, there's a little bit of a populism strain in that. I mean, I remember even covering the Tea Party in 2009 and 2010, where, you know, they would say, you know, keep your hands off my Medicare.
Right.
It needs to be fixed.
Keep your government hands off my Medicare, I think is the line that they were using.
Yeah.
That's NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thanks.
You're welcome as always.
And we want to follow up now on a story that broke last week in Claremont, New Hampshire. The family of a biracial boy saying local teens tried to lynch him. Now, officials in Claremont now say there will need to be many conversations in the city in the coming months about violence and race. And Tuesday night, when about 100 people held a vigil in a park outside City Hall, some of those issues were on display. Breida Green from New Hampshire Public Radio was there.
It wasn't long into the evening that racial tensions were on full display. The event's organizer, Rebecca McKenzie, was just introducing the night's first speaker when she was interrupted by a white man driving by and yelling from his truck. All lives matter, he proclaimed, responding to Black Lives Matter signs in the crowd. Stop making it about race, he said.
Sir, come over.
McKenzie, speaking from the park's gazebo, tried to bring the two sides together.
Sir, come over to our vigil.
The man drove away. McKenzie turned to the crowd and continued with the program.
We have an awful lot of work to do.
And that work starts with responding to an incident that took place just before the start of the school year. A group of Claremont teenagers allegedly attacked an 8-year-old biracial boy, calling him racial slurs before tying a rope around his neck and pushing him off a picnic table. His mother posted a photo of bruises and cuts on his neck to Facebook. She wrote that he was airlifted to the hospital but survived. At the vigil Tuesday, many spoke to broader concerns around racism in the community.
Deep in our bones, that something like this doesn't arise out of a vacuum. White children don't get the idea to lynch a biracial child out of their imagination.
That's John Gregory Davis, a pastor at the Congregational Church in Meriden. One by one, he and other faith leaders spoke, along with city officials and the police chief. Few official details have been released about the alleged attack and investigation. Officials say because the incident involves juveniles, they're limited in what they can say.
It's difficult.
That's Claremont Police Chief Mark Chase. The state attorney general's office is helping his department with the investigation. Social and racial justice groups have urged law enforcement to investigate the alleged attack as a hate crime. Chase says his department will consider any evidence of bias.
It's our obligation, it's our policy, but it's our duty to investigate that as well and consider that as part of the investigation.
Governor Chris Sununu weighed in on Tuesday, condemning hatred and bigotry in a statement. He said he's requested regular updates on the investigation. Meanwhile, the Claremont schools called parents Monday night. The district is looking into ways to explore conversations around racism in the classroom. Details of what that will look like practically are still being worked out. And the same is true at the city level. Claremont recently joined a national program aimed at preventing violence around the city. But when I asked City Manager Ryan McNutt what could be done to address racial tensions, he struggled to find an answer.
I would have to really sit down and think about what we would do, you know, specific for race.
He'd like to keep the dialogue going, he said, to increase diversity of all kinds in Claremont. Like the region as a whole, Claremont is overwhelmingly white, and conversations about race don't always come naturally. As the vigil broke up at dusk, a pickup truck drove around the town square with a full-size Confederate flag waving in the wind. For Here and Now, I'm Breacha Green.
The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime is the wildly engaging book by Mark Haddon about a 15-year-old with autism who decides to solve the mystery of the murder of a neighbor's dog. It was adapted to an equally captivating stage play, and when Indiana Repertory Theater premieres its version on September 17th, it will also have another type of premiere, the first time that the star is portrayed by an actor with autism.
Why would you kill a dog? I think you would only kill a dog if A, you hated the dog, or B, if you were a lunatic, or C, because you wanted to make Mrs. Shears sad. I don't know anybody who hated Wellington, so if it was A, it was probably a stranger. I don't know any lunatics either, so if it was B, it was also probably a stranger. But most murders are committed by someone who is known to the victim.
And he would be right. That's the voice of actor Mickey Rowe as Christopher Boone, an emotional, intense, and physically challenging role that launches his character into an arc of events and relationships, all portrayed through his own lens, the lens of autism. Mickey has long thought Christopher should be played by someone with autism, someone like him. He got his wish. He joins us from the studios of WFYI in Indiana. Mickey Rowe, welcome.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm fine. And I want to establish one thing. I've been saying person with autism. You are perfectly fine with also you characterize yourself as an autistic.
Absolutely. Yeah. A lot of people in the autistic community just say autistic, just like you would say someone is deaf or someone is blind. Mm-hmm. But no matter how you say it, you're not going to get it wrong.
Well, you know what you also are? A star. And we want to talk to you about that. Joining us, your director, Risa Brannon. Risa, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Robin. Happy to be here.
And I have to go back to Mickey because, in getting ready to talk to you, I read the book, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, and I was thinking as I was reading it, because it is narrated by Christopher, your character, mm-hmm. and I was thinking he has a very blunt, detailed way of looking at the world, and I thought, wow, that's a little bit the way a stage narrator is, that this character might lend himself to a play. And then I heard that you maybe feel almost the same way. Tell me how you feel that being autistic maybe even helps with acting.
Well, I think that a lot of autistic people use scripts in their daily lives. So if I'm going into a coffee shop, I might say, "Hi, can I have a large coffee, please?" And then if more chatting is needed, I could say, "Has it been busy today?" And the person will either say, "Yeah, it's been busy," or "No, it hasn't." And then I can say, regardless of what they say, "Oh, would you like it better when it's more busy or when it's less busy?" We have tricks like that that can help us to engage in social situations.
So you've already worked with scripts for quite a while.
Absolutely. And my job when doing that is to make the person think it's a natural conversation happening for the first time, and I'm thinking of those words on the spot. And that's also my job on stage as an actor. And I think the other thing that's nice about theater for people who are on the spectrum is situations where the roles aren't clear are a lot more difficult. So right now it's really easy. You're the interviewer, I'm the interviewee. Mm. You ask me questions and I try to sound smart, and the roles are really, really clear. If you and I were to bump into each other on the street as peers, those roles are a lot less clear and it's a lot more difficult. But on stage, you're literally assigned a role. everyone else in the room has a role, and those roles are really clear. The audience knows that you're playing a role. That's what they want and expect and are paying for. So it makes being on stage very comfortable.
Right. Well, but what happens to your character, Christopher, becomes very frightening. First of all, there is this poor dog that's been killed on his neighbor's lawn, and it sets him off on a trip to find his mother, who he also thought was dead, which has him doing things that, you know, this is someone who's afraid of crowds, who, you know, has to walk along walls at times, and he's going to set off on a train trip to find her in London. Let's just listen to a little of you.
I knew that the train station was somewhere near, and if something is nearby, you can find it by moving in a spiral, walking clockwise, and taking every right turn until you come back to a road you've already walked on. Then taking the next left turn, and then taking every right turn and so on. And that was how I found the station.
We understand that emotion and fear, and this is difficult for someone who has autism. How hard was that for you as an actor to feel somebody else's fear?
There's often a common misconception about people who are on the spectrum that they don't feel emotion or don't have emotion. That's not true for me or for most of the autistics I know. What it is that it's really hard for us to correctly read other people's emotions unless they're being really clear. So in real life, often I'll think someone's really, really mad at me when they aren't at all. Or someone could be really, really mad at me and I don't pick up on that or realize that. That doesn't mean that I don't feel angry myself ever or understand what the emotion is. It just means that I can't always identify that in other people. But in a play, we all sit down and talk about what's happening in each scene, and I've been able to read the play as many times as I want to, analyzing everything that happens before I get in the room.
Well, I want to bring in the director who helped you do that, Risa Brannan, again. Risa, what considerations did you have, considering that Mickey has shared he has a difficulty making eye contact at times, and he may not be able to read your emotions? You know, directors can get pretty emotional. That's part of directing.
One of the things that I've noticed is so interesting, Mickey, listening to you talk about it, because one of the things I've noticed is if I ask you sometimes, you know, well, would you rather do this or this? Sometimes you say, it's up to you, whatever you want to do. And that's interesting, knowing that for you, sometimes it's better to be given a clear direction and then try it, and then we go someplace else. But Mickey is incredibly open, and he's really gifted, and he will jump wherever I ask him to jump, which has been fun.
Well, literally jump. And it's a very physical. He's up on walls.
One of the reasons I cast Mickey, he did an audition for me, and then I went to his website, and I saw this amazing video where he was at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and he was juggling fire while riding on a unicycle. And I thought, okay, this guy is incredible. And then I watched him do a piece that he created with your company about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. And he was doing a kind of movement, very slow movement, but lifting his body off the ground with one arm. And I thought, his skills are so incredible in the movement arena. So we're making use of them as much as possible.
Boy, Mickey, I'm referring to the book, and the play is going to be a completely different thing. But the description, the brilliant, it seems, description by Mark Haddon of his character, Christopher, saying things like, and sometimes when I'm in a new place and there are lots of people there, it's like a computer crashing and I have to close my eyes and put my hands over my ears and groan, which is like pressing Control-Alt-Delete and shutting down programs. Did the character ring true to you?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's something that I think has been nice for Risa and I, is that we can talk from personal experience about different things like Christopher's stimming or his breakdowns.
Stimming?
Which is when often a stereotype with autistic people is that they flap their arms or they might rock back and forth or kind of hit in a rhythmic way. Mm-hmm. And so that would be stimming. And so, you know, I have a beautiful 2-year-old at home and a beautiful 6-month-old baby, and definitely if one of them's crying and then my wife asks me something it can definitely be that overload where you cover your ears and hum, or as they say in the book, groan, because you just can't deal with that much sensory input all at once. But Christopher is definitely also a very different person than I am as well. But I definitely do have a lot of insight into a lot of the things that he does.
You have right now the admiration of a very large community of people. I'm thinking of Matthew Rasa, who writes for Slate, who said, "I'm an autistic person. I have thirsted to see people from our community represent us in popular culture." Have you been hearing that?
Definitely. Every day I get Facebook messages and friend requests from people I don't know. And I think the thing is that there's so much stereotype and misconception about autism. We learn about it from movies like Rain Man or TV shows like Atypical. And in all of these cases, we are watching non-autistic actors directed by non-autistic directors. And so no matter how much research they do, they're coming from a place of their own societal stereotypes. I think that young artists and actors with disabilities need to see role models who will tell them that if you're different, if you access the world differently, then theater needs you and the world needs you.
That's Mickey Rowe. He's starring in the Indiana Repertory Theater production of Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. It's a co-production with Syracuse Stage, so it's going to be moving there for more on the play. You can go to herenow.org. But Mickey's the first actor with autism to play the lead, a character with autism. We've also been talking to his director, Risa Brannan. Mickey, Risa, break legs.
Thank you so much, Robin.
You know, we're thinking a lot of people want to cover their ears when babies become overwhelming. Best of luck again to them.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ziprecruiter.com/here.
The infamous former pharmaceutical executive Martin Shkreli is in jail. A judge decided he violated his bail with bizarre and threatening Facebook postings offering $5,000 to anyone who would grab a hair from former presidential candidate Hillary Clinton during her book tour. Be sure and get a follicle. Shkreli had been free on $5 million bail and was awaiting sentencing in a fraud conviction. Lynette Lopez is senior finance correspondent for Business Insider. She joins us from New York. Lynette, this is somebody who'd already earned animus for jacking up the price of a life-saving drug. He said he was being satirical about the post, but he's also, in exchanges with reporters like Matt Novak, said he had no concern. He felt he wasn't going to jail.
The thing about Martin is that he is a little bit unhinged. He has made websites to go after reporters that have covered his trial. And after, I think, Pizzagate, that whole conspiracy theory that led to a man charging into a pizzeria in D.C. with a gun, authorities are taking threats like this more seriously. And Martin Shkreli does tend to hang out with the dregs of the internet.
Well, in an exchange with this reporter, Matt Novak, he was asked why he did it. And he said, "Hillary Clinton is the greatest threat to national security." He was asked if he was worried about jail. This was before his bail was revoked. He said, "I'm really not. We live in a Trump presidency. Life is basically nirvana."
He'll be thinking about nirvana while he's sitting in jail. The thing about Martin Shkreli that I think is really interesting and that we really need to focus on is that his behavior was so wild and so outlandish, and he has this personality problem to go with it. But there are a lot of other actors in the pharmaceutical industry that are doing exactly what he was doing. And let's remember that he is going to jail for lying to his investors, not for jacking up the price of a life-saving AIDS drug. But he understood the system and how to game it so well that actually back in 2014, he sued a company called Mallinckrodt for Mallinckrodt had bought a drug that would compete with its blockbuster drug. in order to squash it and kill it in the market. Now, Mallinckrodt ended up having to pay a fine for that. Martin Shkreli was happy to rat out the company. But, of course, Mallinckrodt had also jacked up the price of that. Well, before, it had the price of that drug that it was trying to protect was $40,000 a vial. Years before, it had been something around $700. And this week, that very drug was accused by the Journal of American Medicine of not being any more effective than competitors or generics 1/50th of the price. So Martin Shkreli knew this environment very well. It just looking at him and focusing on the fact that he was rude about the Wu-Tang Clan, you kind of miss the forest through the trees, which is that there are a lot of other companies that are engaging in this behavior. They're just not as completely openly disgusting about it.
Or focusing on the fact that he was looking for Hillary Clinton's hair is, again, distracting from the fact that the industry, there's industry-wide problems.
Sure. And he just has a personality problem that kind of amplifies that and was very arrogant about pointing out that he knew how to game the system. And when you read the court documents, it's just sickening how he knew that he could play off of the lax regulation over American drug pricing and the industry in general.
Well, no more. He's sitting in jail awaiting a sentencing. Lynette Lopez, senior finance correspondent for Business Insider. Thank you.
Have a great day.
There is a refugee crisis underway, and it's not in Europe or Africa. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims are fleeing violence in Myanmar that has been described as ethnic cleansing, and they're landing in neighboring Bangladesh. Myanmar's de facto leader, Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi, has come under criticism and has canceled plans to attend the UN General Assembly meeting next week. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said today he spoke with Suu Kyi yesterday, and she agreed the Rohingyas need better access to aid. Joining us from Bangladesh is the BBC's Justin Rowlatt. Justin, first of all, describe the situation there. Where are all these Rohingyas living?
Well, they're just living wherever they can find space. I mean, they've poured into Bangladesh over the last 2.5 weeks, and they are just carving themselves a tiny space on the scrubby hillsides that are the basic landscape here, so between the paddy fields on these hills. And it's monsoon season, so it's very wet. These guys are coming over with nothing. Aid is not being delivered effectively to them, so they're arriving. And I've actually just been to one of the main arrival points on the River Naf, which is the river that divides Myanmar from Bangladesh, and that's one of the key kind of crossing points. They've come across in these actually very beautiful crescent-shaped fishing boats that they use here in Bangladesh. People have packed onto these boats and come across. And actually what you see on this side, the Bangladeshi side, is a huge cattle market. People are coming over, bringing their prized possessions, their wealth with them. And for peasant farmers, obviously their wealth is embodied in their cattle, bringing them over and selling them because immediately they need cash for everything that they're going to do when they're here in Bangladesh. So the poor guys come over in these boats, and the reason we'd gone down to this spot was a tragic event that happened on Monday. One of these tiny fishing boats actually capsized in the river, and 9 bodies were washed up today, which is why we went, and another 10 people were missing. So just another tragic story in this perilous journey that, as you say, hundreds of thousands of people are making. The UN, off the record, have said to me, people within the UN have said, the working assumption at the moment is probably 500,000 in this wave of migration.
And you've been in the camps there. Let's listen to a clip from your report. You met a woman who was 9 months pregnant.
I walked for 7 days to get here. It has been so hard, but we had to escape.
Justin, tell us what happened to that woman.
Well, it was really sad. We met her by a roadside about 4 or 5 days ago now, and she was at the roadside with her extended family, 15, 16 people. The only food they'd got had been thrown to them from a truck by well-meaning Bangladeshis who arrive in these trucks and throw out food, and there's almost kind of riots around them as the refugees gather, desperate to get hold of some food. As we watched, as we were there with her, talking to her, forest guards came and moved them on, said, you can't camp here, you need to move on. And they said, look, there's land over the hill. So they were driven over the hill to this land that supposedly had been assigned to the refugees. And we left, I mean, it was very, very sad indeed. We left them camping out in the open that night. And subsequently, we've been back, and it's taken us a couple of days to find her. We've hiked along. We've been to extraordinary places, hiking through the paddy fields off the road to these new settlements that are sort of randomly growing up on the hillsides. And we've been to quite a few, desperately trying to search for her to find out where she was. And 2 days ago, we found her again, and she's on a kind of hilltop. Rashida, she's called. She's in a bamboo, it's a bamboo frame with a black, thin black plastic sheet stretched over it. A wall on one side, the other three sides completely open to the element. She's 9 months pregnant, due any day. She's got a 1.5-year-old kid, a son who is ill, has this awful hacking cough. Her husband has jaundice, so she's in an absolutely terrible situation. She says the only food she's had, as I say, is from these guys who kind of, you know, freelancers, if you like, who just come down well-meaningly to give food out. No interaction whatsoever with formal aid agencies. And now she's 5 kilometres from the road, and obviously due any day. And the fear is, of course, that she'll have the baby in the on the mud floor of her shack.
Obviously, there are a lot of problems right now just in the temporary situation that you're describing. There are long-term issues here and how Bangladesh is going to handle all of these people. But I think, why don't we take a step back for a second and just remind us what's going on here? Why are these Rohingya Muslims flooding into Bangladesh from Myanmar?
Well, the Rohingya would say that they're a persecuted minority, a Muslim minority within a majority Buddhist nation, Myanmar. They say they've been persecuted for years, and there have indeed been waves of migration out of Myanmar, of Rohingya, into Bangladesh. So, I mean, something which often isn't mentioned, there are already 400,000 Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh. So they're already dealing with a huge kind of refugee issue. But the latest huge wave, by far the biggest wave of migration that we've ever seen out of Myanmar, of Rohingya refugees, was prompted by an attack by an organization called the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army. So a kind of militant army, quite small, we think probably only about 1,000 members, very, very primitive arms, a few guns, some rudimentary weapons, IEDs, that kind of thing. They launched a series of attacks on police posts on August the 25th. There were about, according to the Myanmar government, there were maybe 40 or 50 of these attacks. Not many people killed. We think only about 12 people killed. But the reaction has been absolutely huge. Now, Myanmar calls it a clearance operation. It says it's an anti-terrorist organization. Myanmar won't actually acknowledge the Rohingya, won't even say the word Rohingya. They call these guys Bengalis and say that they're ethnically Bengali, which is the ethnicity of Bangladesh. So they say they're not from here. They're kind of migrants who've come in and have no legal status. They've been stripped by the government of their legal status. Anyway, there's this huge reaction by the military and then mobs of Buddhists, local Buddhists, kind of militias who went in. So, I mean, what we hear from refugees, helicopters came in, shot villagers from the helicopters, poured petrol onto the villages, set fire to the villages and drove these villagers out. Lots of people you meet have bullet wounds. Almost everybody tells the same story, that Buddhist militias and the Myanmar army set fire to their villages and attacked them in the ways that I've described. That's something, of course, that is denied by the Myanmar government.
Which are saying that they burned their own villages, right?
That is exactly what Myanmar is claiming, that as part of this effort to claim statehood, which is what the ASA, the Rohingya Salvation Army, says it's trying to do, as part of this effort for statehood, the allegation is they burnt their own villages, which, as you imply, is a kind of ridiculous way to go about claiming territory, I would argue. So that's what's prompted this. But the reaction, obviously, I mean, actually, when you talk to refugees about what happened, and we've spoken to somebody who actually planted a bomb. He now says, the leader of this organization, ASA, he now wonders whether he was trying to create a state for the Rohingya people or whether he was trying to destroy us, the guy said to us, because he feels the reaction has been so strong and the effect on the community has been so unbelievably catastrophic.
And a lot of the criticism has been pointed toward Aung San Suu Kyi.
Well, absolutely. I mean, she is the de facto leader of the country. I mean, but of course, it's also run by the military. She's always been very ambivalent when she's asked about the Rohingya issue. She often says, well, they're not citizens of Myanmar. You know, they're ethnically distinct. that kind of thing. So yes, she is being, and she has not spoken out against what's happening. She's claimed, as I said, that this is an anti-terror operation. So she's in, this woman who once, remember, embodied, you know, the kind of camp there with Nelson Mandela and Gandhi, right, embodied kind of the battle for human rights, her reputation terribly, terribly tarnished after all of this. And it's easy to see why, because I should mention, today when we were down on the Naf River looking across at Myanmar, there were five huge fires burning. Five fires burning 2.5 weeks after this first, you know, those first attacks. And obviously, I can't say for certain those are villages, but every single day we've been to the border, we see new fires. The villages are made of bamboo. They're made of very basic materials. They probably burn for 3, 4, 5 hours at most. So when you see fires, they're new fires, new villages burning. And that's why the other thing that we saw when we were down at the river was these little boats come bringing refugees across, not the main river, but refugees who'd come over overnight, coming in little fishing boats across a kind of tributary of the Naf and into Bangladesh. Desperate people clinging to their belongings, images that probably everyone that's listening to this program has seen on the television, these awful images happening over and over again. We should say, however, that local people say that the flow is beginning to slow. But that said, refugees that we spoke to say there are still thousands of people on the other side who want to come over to Bangladesh, and seeing those plumes of smoke in the evening light, as I did today, you can understand why they wanted to want to do that.
That's the BBC's Justin Rowlatt joining us from Bangladesh and the unfolding situation there with hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims coming over from Myanmar. Justin, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Good to speak to you.
The mayor of Baltimore says she has no plans to remove the city's monument to Francis Scott Key, which was spray-painted this week with the words "racist anthem." That, of course, refers to the Star-Spangled Banner, which Key wrote 205 years ago today during the Battle of Baltimore in the War of 1812, as he was held captive on a British warship watching the attack from the waters. Now, we've visited this topic before. We'll link you to our 2014 interview with author Mark Leibson, who in his biography of Key points out this American hero was much more complicated than people thought. He was an ardent slave owner who also opposed the mistreatment of slaves. He was a major backer of the move to help free slaves move to Africa to found their own country, Liberia. But he did write this rarely sung third verse of our anthem, condemning slaves who ran away and fought and often died for the British.
Their blood has washed out their footsteps by no refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave.
Well, Carsonia Wise Whitehead teaches communication and African American studies at Loyola University in Baltimore. She is African American. And Kay, you said we can call you Kay. This graffiti may be bringing this verse to the attention of some for the first time. But you used to teach in the Baltimore public schools and heard complaints about it. What did kids say?
Well, it's interesting because for most of my students, and I taught middle school here in Baltimore City for quite a few years, they had never heard of this very racist third stanza. Most people stop after the first stanza. So when I would lay it out for them on paper, they were very concerned. They felt conflicted, which I tell them is the way that we have to look at all of American history. It is complicated. It's contradictory in so many natures. Here is a man who was both an owner of black people, and he fought for some to be free. He wrote this very racist third stanza in the midst of trying to get free from the British. So it's complicated.
Yeah, it is. And now, I'm assuming you would agree with the mayor of Baltimore that the statue should stay, because you say the verse should also stay. Why?
Well, there's a part of me as a historian. I now teach at Loyola University, Maryland, and we talk about how do you whitewash history? What should be removed? Who decide what history needs to stay? And when it comes to this third stanza, I think that that should stay. I think people should read it. I think they should begin to unpack it. I felt very differently with the Confederate statues. I did agree with Mayor Pugh in terms of removing them at one time, middle of the night, just take them down, and let's not continue to lift up people and names that at one time in their lives really committed themselves to keeping us in a condition as black people that we're not in anymore. When it comes to the Francis key statue and what's been happening with it, I think there's a lot of debate and discussion, and I would like to encourage that. I want us to think about the ways in which we are memorialized.
Why? What's the difference between Key, who is singing, and has he ever spoken about this? Do we know for a fact? I mean, it would seem as if he's saying their foul footsteps pollution. He's seeming to say that those who, you know, walked to the British were traitors. Did he ever say that? And what's the difference between him saying that about slaves and the Confederates who fought to keep slavery?
Well, to kind of unpack that and answer the first part, is that because Francis Scott Key, at different points in his life, had worked to help black people who were suing for their own freedom under a 1783 law. He did do some very aggressive work as a lawyer to put a black person in jail who had been found guilty of attacking his white plantation owner, but he also stood in the doorway when a lynch mob had come up to take this man from the jail and lynch him, and it was Francis Scott Key that stopped it. So, complicated history. Mm-hmm. With this patriotic verse of this song that people lift up, I mean, on one hand, he's talking about, you know, what we stand for as Americans as a whole, kind of writ large. But at the same time, he's very bitter about the fact that there were black soldiers who had the audacity to fight for their own freedom. The exact same thing they were doing in the legal battle was the same thing they were doing on the field. I think that when we remove every single piece of a complicated part of our history, we never wrestle with what it means. We never work to get better. Yes, the Confederate statues should be removed. People should not have to walk past these statues that remind them of a time when there were people who were willing to die rather than see black people be free. But with Francis Scott Key, with that particular statue, even the ways in which people are putting vandalism on it and the ways in which we're talking about the verses, it is allowing for this exchange of ideas. It's making us think deeply about them. Now, at some point, we may decide to remove it, but I agree with the mayor at this moment. Leave it there. If keeping this up pushes us toward having that difficult conversation, then I support it.
Yeah, I mean, it is very complicated. A man who is ardently pro-slavery, but ardently stood up for slaves on different occasions, risking his own life. I mean, that's a complicated classroom lesson.
I think that's what American history is. It is a number of contradictions that are done by human beings who say one thing and believe another, who may believe something at 21, and then as they mature, when they get to be 45, they see it differently. That is who we are, and that is something that we wrestle with, and that's what our students should be forced to think about.
Carsonia Wise Whitehead, Associate Professor of Communication and African and African American Studies at Loyola University in Baltimore. Professor Kay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.